May it please the court, counsel, your honors. My name is Mark DeLaQuille, and I'll be arguing on behalf of the industry petitioners and industry respondent interveners, which consist of the Association of Battery Recyclers, Johnson Controls Battery Group, and Dover Run Resources Corporation. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The secondary lead industry is involved in the recycling of spent lead-acid batteries. Its operations are heavily regulated under federal and state law. There are a number of issues in this case, but I'd like to start primarily with our argument that the secondary lead rule under review today unlawfully treats elemental lead as a hazardous air pollutant in violation of Clean Air Act sections 112B2 and 112B7.
Counsel, I just want to start with one perhaps minor issue, but again, a standing issue.
Yes.
It would be true that each one of your claims against the regulation would have to qualify, and you would have to have standing on each one of them, right?
Absolutely.
Now, one of them, terribly complicated one about calculations.
Yes.
What sort of puzzled me there is why you had injury in fact about that, because the government points out that if you were right about your calculations, you were benefited rather than hurt. The only thing you said in response was that wasn't true, but with no explanation. Now, if that is true, you wouldn't have standing on that issue, right?
If that were true, we wouldn't have standing.
Well, there's nothing in your brief to explain why that is not true. The government has said, if you're right about that and we miscalculated, it's to your benefit.
But, Your Honor, our position on this issue
would also has the enormous advantage of allowing me not to try to understand that incredibly complicated arithmetic formula.
I think I, of everyone in this room, understand best how that would be an advantage. In our initial brief, we explained that EPA made two fundamental errors.
No, but you've got to answer the question. Why, if they're right, that your calculation actually benefits you?
They're wrong. The proposal.
You said they're wrong, but you never explained why.
Let me explain why now, please.
Well, it might be a little late.
I believe that this relates back to what we said in our petitioner brief, where we explained how EPA proposed this methodology. They proposed the scaling methodology. It contained the arithmetic error we pointed out, but it also double counted a significant portion of fugitive emissions from the Exide Frisco model facility. What we pointed out in our comments was that your double counting of emissions from Exide Frisco
greatly
overestimates.
They corrected that.
They did correct that. And that your scaling methodology with the error you had in underestimates for some facilities what I'll call the level one facilities, but perhaps overestimates for the more controlled facilities, what I'll call the level three facilities. And our comment was that between the double counting of the fugitive emissions and the arithmetic error, the entire methodology was just flawed and at variance with reality. And in their response brief, EPA pointed out and said, well, you said underestimate, but that wasn't really our position, and I apologize if it wasn't clear enough in the briefs.
I'm still not quite sure what you said was the disadvantage to you of the alleged mathematical discrepancy.
Fugitive emissions are the primary driver of risk in EPA's 112.
Yeah, but they corrected the double counting, right?
Excuse me?
They corrected the double counting. Is that
they
not
corrected
correct?
The double counting, but just correcting the double counting and not changing the scaling factor would have led to a tremendous overestimation of fugitive emissions that was completely inconsistent with the monitored results that they used to ground validate the model.
We'll let the government come back and explain this further. I don't want to divert you so much that you can't get to the main part of your argument.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, I want to divert you for just one more minute on another issue that's of interest to me, and then you can go into your argument, okay? And it relates to the continuous monitoring?
Yes.
Okay. And particularly your argument about 307D?
Yes.
Okay. Suppose EPA assures us in its part of the argument that when the performance specifications are put out for notice and comment, that parties will be free to argue and it is prepared to consider whether, given those performance standards, there should be continuous monitoring at all. In other words, let's assume that everything's open at that next stage. Doesn't that solve that problem?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
This is a final rule binding on the industry right now.
No, you missed my point. The EPA tells us when they stand up that I'm going to ask them this, but that they're prepared to commit that what they intend when the performance specifications are put out for notice comment, that the regulated industry is free to argue and they're prepared to hear an argument that given the nature of the performance specifications, that it will not require continuous monitoring. That's my question.
I think
that it will not require them. That's open for debate and consideration at the next stage. Doesn't that solve your problem?
If EPA were willing to vacate this provision and make a representation,
no, counsel, you're not answering Judge Tatel's question.
I think we'd still be prejudiced by the timing, Judge Tatel.
Why? You have no obligation to do anything until 180 days after it finalizes the performance specifications, right?
Yes.
Okay, so if when we have the notice and comment proceedings, when EPA has it, and if it decides at that point that your arguments about the consequences of the performance specifications are correct, and it cancels the requirement for continuous monitoring, what's the problem?
Your Honor, if all those events occur, I agree.
Okay, great. Now you can go on to your argument.
Now let me ask you to just take another step on the same point that Judge Tatel makes. Why is this any different than the EPA administrator giving a speech indicating that they're planning sometime in the future to issue a requirement for performance for measuring?
Excuse me, do you mean why is our claim that the performance specification will ever be finalized no different than a speech, or the representation that they'll reopen the underlying rule no different than a speech?
No, the former. Why, you're objecting because this is a rule, but it's a rule that has no bite until the performance standards are developed. And of course, as Judge Tatel pointed out, it might even go further because there's nothing to stop you from arguing at that time when the rulemaking comes out that performance standards don't make any sense at all. There's certainly nothing to stop you from making that argument. Why is that any different than the administrator simply making a speech saying, this is what we're planning to do?
Your Honor, the difference is that it's in a final rule.
So what? If it doesn't bite, you said, oh my gosh, it creates uncertainty. The same uncertainty would be created by a speech.
I think, Your Honor, that there's more uncertainty created when it's put in the Federal Register than when it's given in.
We could put the speech in the Federal Register. Would that help? Would that change it? They can do that.
I think that probably would not change our view. I think there's a fundamental difference between telling a facility, if you're new or reconstructed, and EPA when we finalize a performance specification, which we intend to do, you'll be on the hook for continuous compliance despite the fact you didn't consider it in the underlying rule, and you may have to shut down, you may be liable for $37,000, $500 a day in penalties, than just a speech.
Okay.
So I'd like to address our primary argument in this case, that the rule unlawfully treats elemental lead, quote unquote, in effect as a hazardous air pollutant. We believe the rule does that for three primary reasons. First, the Section 112F risk analysis underlying the rule was found unacceptable risk from the source category as a result of lead NACS exceedances in the areas surrounding the industry smelters. Second, EPA set the revised Section 112F standards at a level it believed would eliminate those exceedances of the lead National Ambient Air Quality Standards. And third, EPA did so by adopting state lead attainment provisions from the SIP, primarily from Southern California Air Quality Management District Rule 1420. There's a good reason Congress separated the NAAQS program from the Section 112 program. Under the NAAQS, which
But it didn't
the
change. There's no change in the NAAQS program, right?
There's no change in the NAAQS.
Correct? None at all. And a smelter could completely satisfy its standards under this rule, even if the NAAQS aren't met, correct, and vice versa.
That's correct.
So I don't understand the problem.
The problem is that Clean Air Act Section 112B2 precludes any rule under Section 112 that in effect treats a NAAQS pollutant as a hazardous air pollutant. By setting standards that EPA specifically intends to address NAAQS exceedances, and I think that's uncontested that that's the primary risk basis for its rule, and adopting controls that it has concluded will make NAAQS attainment in the area surrounding the smelter, that it's quote-unquote, in effect, treated elemental lead as a hazardous air pollutant. They could have done this just for lead compounds, but they didn't. They instead used the lead NAAQS, which is a measure of risk from elemental lead. And we believe under the teaching of National Lime Association that that constitutes treating it in effect. I'd like to briefly also address the Section 112D6 rationale for this rule. We believe the Section 112, this rule rests on two bases, a Section 112 risk basis and a Section 112D6 technology basis. We believe the Section 112F risk basis is unlawful for the reasons I just described. That basis was also necessary to the Section 112D6 determination because EPA refused to independently consider public health and risk under Section 112D6 because of the 112F analysis. In addition, EPA refused to consider numerous other factors that were in the record and presented by the industry petitioners and others, such as whether revisions were quote-unquote necessary in light of other control programs, such as the NAAQS.
You're really swimming upriver when you're fighting about their judgment as to what is necessary, aren't you?
Well, I understand, Your Honor, that necessary is ambiguous. We don't contest that. But when Congress tells EPA to act as necessary, it's giving it a broad delegation.
Right. Your problem.
Understood. In our view, Your Honors, incumbent in a broad delegation is to consider all of the relevant points made in the administrative record and to articulate a rational reason for declining to follow them. And relying on an unlawful risk analysis, not to consider public health, or refusing to consider other control programs, we believe is inconsistent with that broad delegation of authority.
Okay.
Your Honors, I'd like to briefly address our argument.
Do you have any time left?
50 seconds.
Go ahead.
The environmental petitioners lack Article III standing. Mm-hmm. 2 points. Their challenge is to this rule, which requires a 90% reduction in emissions and total enclosure of facilities in the industry. They say that, but none of their affidavits address whether there would be an injury after the imposition of those controls.
Wait a minute, who are you, whose standing are you challenging?
The environmental petitioners standing as
not RSR.
We're also challenging RSRs under the shareholder standing and
but,
zone of yeah, interest.
Their argument is that under D6, EPA's D6 analysis is flawed because it didn't revise the MAC standard.
Yes.
And if they're right about that, which we have to assume for purposes of standing, correct?
Yes.
These standards would be significantly lower.
They would be lower.
Or tougher.
I don't believe
that. So there's their standing.
2 points, Your Honor. First, their argument goes only to stack technology. The primary driver of risk in this industry is fugitive emissions, so it won't even address that.
Let me just ask you, if they're correct, about their theory about MAC technology having to be revised. The MAC standard has to be. Won't they be, aren't they harmed?
No, Your Honor.
No?
They would still need to be injured by what EPA did, not by EPA's failure to do more. But to have an injury in fact...
That's not the way we think about standing.
I don't understand that at all, counsel. That doesn't make sense.
But their, Your Honor, as I understand their claim, it's that they're injured by the delta between what this rule does and what it should do if EPA reset MAC standards and based them on an alternative control
technology. And we have to assume, for purposes of standing, that they're correct about that.
I believe they have to still demonstrate an injury in fact.
Well, that's the merits.
We may assume that redressability could be cured on remand, assuming there was an available...
Well, counsel, wouldn't the error be arguably better? Therefore, the people they represent would be benefited?
But, Your Honor, I think there's still... The fundamental issue here is risk. EPA characterized the risk after impositions of this controls in the record. They found that no persons would be exposed to lead concentrations that exceed the NACs, and they found that there would be one excess cancer case in 100 years. I don't believe that anything beyond that constitutes a substantial probability of an injury in fact.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay. We next the environmental, right? Petitioners? Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. Emma Chus for Environmental Petitioners, California Communities et al. The court should reband EPA's rule to follow 112(d)(2-3) of the Clean Air Act. Congress enacted these important provisions to protect communities from toxic carcinogens like arsenic and cadmium, and the neurotoxin lead, which has no safe level of human exposure. EPA contends that nothing says it needs to follow those requirements here, but in fact, 112(d)(2) says just that. 112(d)(2) directs that emission standards promulgated under this subsection, i.e. 112D, must comply with these important requirements. The lead standards here are indisputably emission standards promulgated under this subsection, 112D. Therefore, 112(d)(2) decides this case.
And I thought it was three you were really concerned about. D3, I thought it was your major concern.
Well, Your Honor, D2 and D3 come as a pair under this court's precedent, cement kiln and others.
Ham and eggs.
And D3 itself repeats the same language, well, emission standards.
What about, why don't you deal with the antecedent question here, which is whether this issue was resolved in NRDC versus EPA?
Thank you, Your Honor. In that case involving the synthetic chemicals rule.
Well, that's not a distinction, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. The court did not decide whether 112(d)(2) applies to revised emission standards.
Quote, we do not think the words, quote, review and revise as necessary can be construed reasonably as imposing such obligation, namely the same obligation you're arguing here.
Well, Your Honor, the court was interpreting 112(d)(6) in that case, and 112(d)(2) independently requires, however EPA has revised emission standards, it requires emission standards promulgated.
Wasn't the argument in that case that when making a D6 adjustment, EPA had to recalculate the MAC standards, the MAC levels? Wasn't that the argument?
Your Honor, the court was considering the argument that those provisions apply to a review under D6, and in that review...
Why does that matter?
Yeah.
It matters, Your Honor, because as the court pointed out in that case, it was an unusual bit of rulemaking where there were no revised standards. It was a decision not to revise, and so it was interpreting...
But if you take the sentence to which Judge Tatel alluded, that doesn't seem to depend on the question of whether there was... going to be a revision this time or not, did it? That time or not, did it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the sentence that Judge Tatel was quoting is a direct quote from the language of D6, showing that the court did not resolve what would happen if
It includes the quote, review and revise, but the language is, we do not think that the words review and revise as necessary can be construed reasonably as imposing any such obligation, that being an obligation to reset the MAC.
Well, Your Honor, even aside from the language of D6, D2 governs all emission standards promulgated under this subsection, and that includes the initial promulgation or a revision. So Congress was clear.
That's the same argument they made in that case.
Yeah.
That's because I see your point about D2. I get your point about looking at the statute. And it does say emission standards issued under this section, and that includes D6. I got that. But wasn't that the same argument that was made in NRDC?
Your Honor, they contended that those provisions applied to a review, but they could not have argued that EPA must satisfy these provisions when there are revised emission standards. In that case, the court focused on the fact that there were no developments, which would...
No, that was an alternative holding, right? There were two holdings there.
Or at least two.
The additional language in that case that's important is the court's recognition that the use of cost under D6 would be troublesome, pointing to this court's...
Next paragraph, though. That's not in the same language with what we just quoted you. That's in the next paragraph, which is just what it says, can constitute an alternate holding.
Well, Your Honor, it is in the next paragraph, but that language refers
it
to the
integral.
It is, and it refers to the integral inquiry at issue here, which is if D2 and D3 apply, EPA may consider cost only at the beyond the floor stage. And the court's recognition that the consideration of cost would be troublesome under D6 incorporated all of the court's precedent under 112D2-3 that says EPA may not consider cost at the floor stage. The court in...
Counsel, I have to say that your argument in this case strikes me as better than the one the NRDC brought in the last case.
Jamie, you weren't here then.
Yeah, but there was not even a petition for rehearing after that case, after the decision came down.
Thank you, Your Honor. The language of D2, I would submit, is a completely separate question, again, from the language the court was considering.
Let me ask you this question. Your basic argument is if the EPA, at the eight-year point, must go back to the MAT floor. That's your fundamental argument. Now, is that argument so strong, take you to the point that even if there was a minor revision under subsection 6, that would be illegal?
No, Your Honor. A minor revision would not be a change to the emission standards and D2.
No, a minor revision of the emission standards.
Sure.
Suppose they wanted to just make a really minor change.
If they're changing the emission limit, Section 302K of the Act defines emission standard as a limit on emissions.
Your view is if they're going to change the emission standard even a little bit, they've got to go back to 3.
Yes, Your Honor, because that is what Congress said in D2, and it was a careful framework that Congress set up in that EPA's...
Congress didn't explicitly say that. You make a really good argument in terms of the reasonableness of the statutory interpretation, but Congress never explicitly said when the agency does the revising as necessary under 6, they must go back to the 2 and 3.
Your Honor, Congress did not need to say that because it was already clear in D2, and the only explicit exception it chose to include from D2 is D5 for area sources. The court has not generally required Congress to be redundant or add extra language in order to be clear, and that's an important point in terms of looking at D2. D2 says emission standards promulgated. Congress could not have been clearer by using that term. And EPA has given no...
Oh, counsel, you've got to admit Congress could be clearer on this.
You know, it's true. Congress could always be clearer. But the court generally has interpreted the language as written and
applied. You know, it's sort of puzzling that Congress in 6 specifically referred to certain factors, not factors related, and didn't refer back to 2 and 3.
The factors in D6 govern when and whether EPA must revise, and the factors fit the purpose Congress designed them for well.
Suppose take, for example, the facts of NRDC, where everybody agreed there were no developments and practices in processes and control. There were none of those in that case, right?
Right.
But suppose over the 8 years, and let's assume that the MAC floor was determined on the basis of 5, the top 5, just like here. Suppose for whatever reasons, the top 5 were performing significantly better with the same equipment, would EPA have to recalculate the MAC standard?
Your Honor, that would go to the question of whether that constitutes a development, and EPA has decided in this case that it improved efficiency of a technology in use.
That's a new development.
Is a new development. EPA acknowledged that here. And that's, you know, Congress used the
way you read D6 is that if there's been any changes, the EPA at that 8-year period has to recalculate the MAC floor and then go on to the second question as to whether it will go beyond the floor also, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And Congress...
And explain to us once more why the first part of that isn't resolved in NRDC. I mean, I realize that the cases are different because there were no developments, and here there are, right?
Yes.
But why would that make a difference for purposes of the holding in NRDC, or the sentence in NRDC that rejects the argument that the MAC floors need to be recalculated?
Well, Your Honor, the court decided there.
The two cases.
Well, there's an additional difference, which is you actually have revised emission standards before you that were not present.
Well,
however,
that's why I asked my question the way I did.
That language refers to, in that case, the court decided that EPA did not need to just go ahead and perform the analysis under D2, D3 before it found developments. Congress laid out. Use D6 as a filter.
That was the second sentence.
No, the recalculate the MAC floor goes to D2, D3. That's what, but the petitioners were...
I'm talking about the sentence in the opinion. We do not think sentence goes to the question of recalculating the MAC floor.
Yes, Your Honor.
The second sentence goes to the question of technological developments.
Well, Your Honor, the recalculation sentence, I believe, is the one that you're focusing on, and the court decided that EPA did not need to recalculate or follow D2, D3 when there had been no developments. It made a decision that EPA had logically...
But it says that the words review and revise is necessary. We do not think the words review and revise can be construed reasonably as imposing any such obligation, that being the obligation to recalculate the MAC.
Yes, Your Honor, in the absence of developments and the facts before it, there was no reason. Well, the fact is the court was looking at a situation where there were no revised standards, and the court was saying...
Well, it goes on to say even if the statute did impose such an obligation, then petitioners have not identified any post-1994 technological innovation. But that rather plainly sets up an alternative when you say even if. It would seem to be rather plain that sentence taken alone means what it means, even taken in light of the second sentence.
Yeah, and just to add to Judge Santel's point, that was the primary argument that NRDC made in the case. In other words, NRDC chose to litigate that case by arguing that D6 required recalculation of the MAC floors. And this sentence resolves that issue.
Your Honor, D6, it does resolve the question of what EPA's requirement is when it's deciding when and whether to revise. To do so, it only needs to follow the core requirement to look at developments. And the court held that is an elemental part of its holding, even ignoring whether D6 itself is clear, which is all the court resolved in that case. D2 independently steps in for the first time when there are revised emission standards. And here EPA found it was necessary to revise because it found developments existed. And that led directly to the directive in D2, D3 that applies to emission standards promulgated under this subsection. The court could not have gone so far as to resolve that ultimate question because it was only looking at the question of whether you're only in the filter of D6, you have to then make that ultimate decision. The discussion of cost is troublesome, is extremely important as well to show that the court was not resolving whether D6 requires EPA to calculate minimum stringency floors without consideration of cost, because those questions can't be separated. If EPA were only under D6, it has not provided any basis under applicable precedent to be able to consider cost except by pointing to D2 in what is in itself a Freudian slip that's telling the only way it knows how to ultimately set emission standards is to look to D2, D3.
What about the other section of the which is puzzling me no end, Section F, which does take into account cost, and which was also relied on when this rule was promulgated.
Well, Your Honor, that is a different provision which includes different language, and the court applied a clear statement rule in its holding on 112F following Whitman.
Yeah, F is does allow cost.
The court held in that case that EPA could consider cost applying Whitman, recognizing there needed to be a clear statement and finding.
What I'm saying is, in this case, EPA relied on both D and F, right, together. They both were authority for the, and F talks about cost. D2 talks about cost. So cost floats around twice.
You're right, Your Honor, and of course, most of the issues on the 112F rules are currently held in abeyance, but that is exactly right. D2 is the way at the beyond the floor stage, as EPA has recognized. That is how they may consider cost. But Congress created a sound policy where it would filter new when changes had occurred in the industry. It wanted to make sure that the communities continued to get protection from toxic air pollution as developments made that possible. The term developments points to the question of showing that greater emission reductions can be achieved because they have been.
Your argument makes sense if we're not bound by NRDC. But if we're bound by NRDC, then what's the problem with the EPA taking account of costs here?
Well, two points, Your Honor. The court is not bound by NRDC.
I know that.
Because
I know that's what you think.
Of D2. However, if it were, that case did not resolve whether EPA can consider cost. It called it troublesome.
But if we're bound by that, that is, if recalculation of the is not necessary, you don't have to do that, then we're in D2 land, and as Judge Silverman said, F land, and they both authorize the use of costs. And you were making the point, well, that's cherry picking, but the fact is that NRDC says that they don't have to recalculate the MAC floors.
Well, under D6, whether or not they would have to perform the minimum floor requirement, they could not consider cost under the plain language of D6, based on Whitman requiring a textual commitment.
I suppose you're right, that let's assume for a minute that you're correct, that NRDC is not binding and that you're right on the interpretation statute. Then for D6, right, they would recalculate the MAC floor, not considering cost, right? But in terms of going beyond the floor, they could consider cost, couldn't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that is exactly what we believe they should do. They should follow the framework that Congress...
But my point is, if NRDC is binding, the first part of that's out, off the table, for purposes of this panel.
It would be binding under D6, but it does not resolve the separate question of how an emission standard comes before the court. Looks like my opening time has run out.
Well, you spent it on the key issue. Don't worry about that.
So I will look forward to rebuttal. Thank you.
Morning. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Counsel, may I right at the outset suggest that your biggest problem, it seems to me, is standing. We have case after case after case holding that a competitor does not have standing, prudential standing, under a regulatory statute to seek greater regulation of competitors.
Well. As we stated in our brief, under the Supreme Court precedent and the Animal Legal Defense Fund case, the zone of interest test is met when the entity is regulated by the standard under review.
Well, if you're regulated, if you're facing increased regulation, of course you have standing. But that's not your concern. Your concern is you want to impose greater regulation on somebody else. And we have case after case holding that you do not have prudential standing when you do that, and that's been raised by some of your opponents here.
There is no case, Your Honor, that I've been able to identify that suggests that if the party is regulated by the standard under review, that the zone of interest test is even brought to bear. And I'd like to also point out that even if the even if there was a standing issue here, under a very long line of cases, the court's inquiry into standing is pretermitted because we're presenting claims the same as other parties. The most recent case deciding this was Canning v. NLRB, decided by Judge Santel just this year.
I think I've heard of it.
We can take your argument as amicus, of course, but not as intervener.
Under that line of cases, the argument.
Your position is precisely the same as that by another party. Then there is not a need, a necessity requiring. We have some FERC reviews to that effect also that probably are closer on point than Noel County.
Yes, Your Honor.
Insofar as you're making exactly the same argument as the environmentalist, but you're making some separate arguments. That's the problem.
All of our arguments are within the ambit of the claims of the environmentalists, and I'd like to make one critical point.
Does that include their argument about recalculating the MEC?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. The NRDC decision, let's start from the premise that the court is bound by that decision. Then the next inquiry must be, can EPA's construction be reconciled with that decision? And it cannot, because that decision discusses National Lyme Association and the consideration of cost in the floor determination, and under EPA's construction, there is no floor determination under 112D6. So there is no way you can reconcile the court's decision in NRDC with EPA's preferred construction of the statute. There must be some sort of floor determination, or the court would have had no reason to discuss it greater length than the...
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that NRDC is wrongly decided? Is that what your argument is?
No, I'm saying that you cannot reconcile the different components of the NRDC decision in a manner consistent with EPA's preferred construction.
Okay.
And
no, I don't really understand yet. Now, can you change the wording of that and see if you can help me understand why your argument isn't that NRDC is wrongly decided?
Yeah, I must say I don't understand. I joined Judge Santel in expressing
the only way that me too. The only way that if you construe the first paragraph in NRDC that has been the subject of so much discussion as completely precluding any floor determination, yes,
it doesn't preclude. It doesn't require. It doesn't say there can't be a floor determination. It said that they're not compelled to do it. But
well, if they're not compelled, why does the court then discuss it so much length in the subsequent paragraph? Exactly what would happen
is
if a floor determination
that NRDC is wrongly decided? Is that what you're arguing to?
No, my argument is that the paragraph that has been quoted is being misconstrued.
If it's rightly decided, then why isn't it binding upon us that paragraph or that sentence of that paragraph establishes that EPA is not required to recalculate?
Well, first of all, with respect to the new source MAC floor, which is a matter of great and important critical significance here, there is no recalculation. There's nothing to calculate. It's based on a single facility, and that is a critical underlying statutory premise of...
What does that got to do with the price of tea? I lost it.
I'm not following either how that addresses the question.
There's nothing to recalculate under the new source floor.
Maybe Judge Santel and I are too old, so direct it to Judge Tatel. Maybe he can understand.
I would like the
record. I'm all ears. Go ahead.
Appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, Judge Tatel is older than I am.
Oh.
Barely. Go ahead.
Let me try one more time, Your Honor. The discussion of National Lyme Association is based on what can be done in a floor determination. There would be no reason for the court to have gone through that discussion if there is no circumstance where a floor determination would be made.
You just said national lime. Do you mean natural resources?
I'm sorry?
You said national lime. Did you mean natural resources?
No, I meant national lime. The discussion of National Lime Association in the NRDC decision, in the paragraph that begins with "more troublesome," however, there is no way that that paragraph has any relevance if there is no circumstance where a floor determination will be made under 112D6.
Wait a minute. You just overstated. It doesn't hold that there cannot be a floor of determination made as a review and revise under 6. It doesn't say that, as Judge Sentell said a moment ago. It says it's not required.
Well, but then why is it troublesome EPA made no floor determination
because
there?
Because what was troublesome in that case was not the, as I'm looking at the language, it's not the decision not to revise the standards, which was before the court then, but the original standard. Quote, EPA may have done just that in setting the initial floors. That's what the court's talking about. It may have taken account of costs in setting the initial floor. But the time period for challenging those standards is long past. Obviously, it can't consider costs when it set the initial floor. That's not the D6 question.
What the court found troublesome was not just what happened in the original promulgation, but the possible repetition in the subsequent reconsideration rule.
Yeah, but that, I mean, even if you're right about that, that's got to be dictum. I mean, nothing in the opinion turned on that. I bet even Judge Silberman agrees with me about that.
In any case, Your Honor, there is no recalculation in determining what EPA calls the new source MAC floor. Recalculation occurs only in the context of the existing source MAC floor. EPA's policy argument about ratcheting is only applicable to the existing source MAC floor. The NRDC language is by its literal language only applicable.
Excuse me, I just want you to focus on this language. I just don't see how you can read the NRD decision as anything other than focusing on the initial. It says, yet the time period has long since passed, which raises the question of whether the reaffirmation of the cost base gives rise to a new claim. That's what the court's talking about there. It's not talking about the
redetermination.
What was troublesome to the court was that in the agency's decision in that case not to revise them, they were reiterating an earlier standard that may have taken account of costs. That's what was troubling the court.
Yes, but in reiterating that standard, if there was no floor determination, then there would be no applicability of national lime.
The court's point was that there may have been a violation of national lime when the standards were originally issued. And the question was whether the agency's decision to leave them in place provided a new opportunity to challenge that. That's the way I read this. You don't think that's right?
No, I don't.
I just read you.
I really don't think that's
really
right.
Well, what about this language?
What
about the language I read you? EPA may have done just that in setting the initial floors, yet the time period for that has passed, which raises the question whether EPA's reaffirmation of its cost-based decision provides a new opportunity. Just focus on that language. That's all I'm asking you about. Why am I misinterpreting that?
Well, I think you're interpreting it correctly with respect to the original determination. Yeah. The question is whether or not the court had any occasion to consider it in the context of the subsequent determination. And if it didn't, there would be nothing to find troublesome. If there was no floor determination upon reconsideration, then there is nothing to find troublesome and no need to decide whether or not the original standard was correctly promulgated or not.
Don't you recognize that sometimes courts write dicta?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that arguably this case, whether correctly decided or not, is dicta because there were no developments and processes.
The whole case is dicta.
Then. Right. Yeah.
No, just this determination with respect to the MAC floors, yeah. Because okay. There had been no determination of practices, processes, or control technology. No
more. Okay, you're way over your time.
Yes,
so, thank you. Okay, now we'll hear from the EPA, correct? Right, okay.
Good morning. Okay. Good morning, Your Honor. Angeline Purdy, representing EPA, and with me is Stephen Silverman of EPA's Office of General Counsel. Because there are a wealth of issues in this case, unless the court has specific questions for EPA, I'm going to focus on the issues that have come up in oral argument from the petitioners. Beginning with the industry arguments concerning the claim that we are regulating lead.
Before you do that, can we just get the continuous monitoring out of the way?
Yes.
Okay. You heard my question to counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Am I right that, or not? I don't want to ask it that way. When the agency issues the performance specifications, right, puts them out for notice and comment, will the regulated parties be able to argue that given those, there should be no continuous monitoring requirement at all?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where do we see that in anything? Is that in the rule? Because the rule doesn't say that. In your brief says that they can challenge it in court. But my question is, will the agency consider it in the regulatory process? You see my point?
In terms of the regulatory process, I think the agency would consider any comments that were submitted as part of that process.
But is the agency, if we put in our opinion that the agency will, in fact, not only permit comments that continuous monitoring is not required, but that issue is in fact on the table from EPA's perspective.
We would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
What has to be as a matter of administrative law.
Exactly.
Any major comment.
Because if it isn't, you got a 30D, a 307D problem. You agree with that, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Consistent both with general principles of administrative law that the agency is required to respond to all comments received, and consistent with this court's precedent construing 307D and claims ripening. On both fronts, we would concede that yes.
But you agree the only way to solve your 307D3 problem is a commitment now that everything's on the table when the performance standards are issued, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Now, go ahead.
Turning first to the argument that we are supposedly regulating lead as a hazardous air pollutant through this rule, the rule on its face regulates lead compound emissions. EPA is using, as it has used since the standard was originally promulgated in 1995, a test methodology that measures total lead in stack emissions.
What's the difference between total lead and elemental lead?
Total lead would include all lead both in its compound form and in its elemental form. Most of these emissions are in lead in compound form. By measuring total lead, EPA is capturing all of that.
Is there any difference between measuring the lead in compound and measuring the elemental lead?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. Are you asking if there are test methods that discriminate between the two?
No, I'm asking, as a chemical matter, aren't you measuring the same thing if you're measuring elemental lead or the amount of lead that's in the compound?
If a total lead measurement is going to pick up all the lead that is in that emission, whether that lead exists bound to another substance as a compound or whether it exists by itself. So
elemental lead, by definition, is independent of everything else.
Yes.
That's the point you're making.
It's not.
If it's mixed up.
No, compounded, not mixed.
No.
Yeah, compounded, excuse me. I apologize.
That's not the same thing chemically, right? Instead of compound, you've got a molecular binding between the PB molecule, or atom or molecule, and some other molecule to make a compound. If it's mixed, then you have free lead that's simply whirled together in a molten state or something, but you still have elemental lead within the mix, right?
I believe that's generally correct, yes, Your Honor. Now, most of the lead that is emitted from these facilities...
No, I had a feeling you were going to agree with that no matter what.
Getting back to the basic point, though, what we're regulating here are lead compounds. The testing method picks up both elemental lead and lead compounds. First of all, this claim is time-barred. We've been using the exact same measurement methodology since we first promulgated this standard in 1995. Under this court's decision in Medical Waste Institute, this claim is not even properly before the court. But if the court were to consider it, the points that the industry petitioners have raised are not persuasive. They are concerned with the measurement methodology, which, as we pointed out, measures all the lead in these emissions. They point to the fact that EPA used the level of the lead NAx to assess risk. The propriety of that is not before the court at this time because the 112F issues have, for the most part, been severed and obeyed. But what EPA was doing was using a health-based standard to look at health risks in its 112F review. Industry petitioners have also pointed out that EPA looked at measures that states may have taken to implement the lead NAx. That was simply part of EPA's consideration of developments in emissions control. So they've offered no persuasive reason to believe that what EPA was doing here was actually regulating elemental lead. We think what EPA did here, both in its measurement methodology and its use of lead as a surrogate for other pollutants, is squarely within what this court allowed in National Lyme Association.
Counsel, with respect to the miscalculations,
yes,
that you indicated, and my dialogue with counsel, you pointed out in your brief that even if petitioners were correct, they'd be better off. And in response, in the reply brief, they simply say they're wrong but don't explain. Arguably, that's not adequate to put the issue put the issue before us, to just say they're wrong. But anyway, would you explain to us why they really don't even have standing on this specific issue because they're not injured?
They're not injured, Your Honor, because EPA's conclusion that that there were risks associated with these fugitive emissions from secondary lead facilities was driven by the emitters at the very highest end of the range, the one or two top emitters. The industry petitioners are arguing that EPA should have taken its baseline facility, the Exide Frisco facility, and that EPA should have actually used a multiplication factor that EPA used for all the other facilities at that level one of no controls. And should have multiplied.
They argue you misstate Frisco.
I don't think they're arguing that we misstate Frisco so much as that we should have taken Exide Frisco's emissions, which we were using, estimated emissions, which were used as a baseline, and multiplied those by 1.07, which is the factor that we use for other level one facilities. If we'd done that, Exide Frisco's emissions would have been higher. There would have been more emissions at the upper end of the range.
If they are raising the same issue as parties who undoubtedly have standing, does it matter whether they have standing or not?
If they're raising the same issue as parties who have standing, I don't think it would, but I don't know of any other parties who have raised this issue.
This is not RSJ. This is the main petitioner argument.
These are the main petitioners.
Oh, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Correct.
I thought we were talking about the RS.
No.
I was thinking about the other standing argument. I apologize.
So, again, as I say, if EPA had calculated Exide Frisco up the way they appear to be suggesting, we would have simply had more emissions at the higher end. It would have further supported EPA's conclusion. The other alternative is if EPA had taken the Exide Frisco emissions down, had classed it with level 2 facilities, yes, it's true there would have been slightly lower emissions at those level 2 and 3 facilities, but those were not what drove EPA's risk conclusions here. So either way, it makes no difference to EPA's ultimate determination, and for that reason you're correct that they are not injured. To the extent that the court is concerned with the specific calculations, there's a good explanation in the record at JA 211, 215, and particularly page 213 lays out exactly where those factors came from. Looking at the environmental petitioner's arguments, we wholeheartedly agree that NRDC is binding.
We agree with who?
I beg your pardon?
Agree with who?
I agree with the court that...
Well, we haven't said what we think.
Beg your pardon?
We were just asking questions.
I beg your pardon.
And it does look like the second sentence suggests
that the first was not necessary to the decision because the court said the parties, the NRDC hadn't identified any developments. So the first sentence was unnecessary to the decision, which is classic dicta.
I disagree with that reading, Your Honor.
I thought you might, but why?
I believe that the court stated unequivocally in the first sentence that the words review and revise as necessary can't be construed to require, can't reasonably be interpreted to require EPA to recalculate
right,
the MAC floor.
Right, that's what it says.
It then stated in the alternative that even if they could be interpreted that way, EPA had not made any revisions here. So that's an alternative.
So in your view, dicta doesn't, you can create a holding even if it's not necessary to resolve the case?
I think it was necessary to resolve the case in the sense that these precise arguments.
Once you put it, counsel, in terms of alternative holdings, we do that all the time.
I think that you could have, whether you characterize that second sentence as an alternative holding or whether that itself was dicta, either way, you've still got the primary holding, which is that the words, these particular words in Section 112d6 can't reasonably be interpreted the way that the environmental petitioners are now seeking to interpret them.
What about their argument that this case is different because in that case the agency made a decision not to revise under D6? Whereas here, it made a decision to revise, but didn't take account, didn't revise the MAC floor. That's their argument, as I read their brief. That's their key argument, that's why the cases are different.
Yes, Your Honor, but we think that given the language of NRDC, that's not a persuasive distinction. The court's language was very clear as to what the scope of it, what it was holding with regard to the interpretation.
Why isn't it possible that if there are concededly no new technological developments, then there's no obligation to revise the floors. But where there are, that's a different issue, which wasn't addressed here in NRDC because that didn't face that kind of case.
I think it's true that the court was not facing that factual situation in NRDC. I still come back to the clarity of the language that it employed. It didn't have to use such sweeping language. It didn't limit that holding to the specific situation where there is no revision. So I think I would again come back to the fact that the court used such sweeping language and made such a clear statement that these words, and it didn't merely hold that EPA's interpretation of the statute not to require recalculation of MAC floors was reasonable. It said it's not reasonable to construe it the other way.
Okay.
There are other attempts. I beg your pardon?
No, go ahead.
There are other efforts.
I must confess that troubles me now because if I had to look at it ab initio, I would say that the agency could reasonably construe it either way. But you're right. We did say it so strongly the last time.
Yes. I'd say there are further efforts.
My view is that the statutory sections are quite ambiguous. And therefore, probably EPA has authority to go either way.
I think these provisions are ambiguous, and I think EPA's reading of them is reasonable. I think the court has already recognized that, but I think it would stand as reasonable on its own.
Why is that? Let me just ask you about that.
Yes.
Okay, let's assume we're not bound by NRDC.
Yes.
Okay, so D2 says that, quote, standards issued under this subsection, right? That's D, right? And that includes D and D6, right? Shall require a MAC floor, right? And D6 directs it to review and revise them. So I don't see how, assuming we're not bound by NRDC, why the agency isn't required at the D6 level to recalculate the MAC floors, particularly given what Congress's purpose was here, right? I mean, Congress put this in there because it wanted a technology-driven driven standard. It wanted to limit EPA discretion. And so it said when you initially issue these, it's got to be, in this case, set at the top five. And why would Congress have conceivably wanted, you know, a more discretionary approach 8 years later? Which is, your view is that the D2 just drops out, right, after it's first done. There's no D3, I mean.
D3 drops out.
Yeah. That's your point, right? It never comes up again.
The factors in D2 can remain relevant to the inquiry, so I wouldn't say it just completely vanishes from the horizon.
But what about just the language of the statute? It says that standards promulgated under this subsection, which includes D6, right, shall require max standards, max floors. The language seems.
Neither D6 nor D2, neither one explicitly cross-references the other. D6 does not say you should.
Sure it does. It says under this subsection.
But
that you agree that includes D6, don't you? How can it not include D6? That's a perfect cross-reference. True, D6 doesn't go back and say D2, but that's not, Congress doesn't have to do that. They don't have to say we really, really, really mean to cross-reference it, right? They did it in D2.
I think in looking at whether what Congress intended by saying subsection was really to make EPA to go back in a Section 112 D6 review and completely recalculate the MAC floor, start fresh, you have to look at the potential consequences that would impose on the industry and question whether Congress would not have employed clearer language.
But isn't it exactly what Congress would have intended? It's a technology-driving statute. If the top five, if technology improves, they should increase the standard, or lower this, whatever it is. It's above, beyond, change the standard. I mean, this case is a perfect example, right? 85% of them meet the standard that EPA issued. That clearly would not satisfy, the top, if you were using the top five, it would be significantly lower. So I just don't understand how this fits into A, the language of the statute, and B, what Congress intended. Of course, this is all hypothetical if, in fact, we're bound by NRDC.
Certainly, Congress did intend that EPA periodically look at developments in emissions control and assess existing emission standards in light of that review. That's why Section 112D6 is there. Yeah. Every 8 years, EPA goes back, looks at developments, looks at whether it is necessary to review and
revise. What do you think if necessary doesn't mean necessary to revise the MAC floor, what does necessary mean?
Necessary means, in this context, whether it's necessary to revise the existing emission standards.
Well, what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. There's no limit to that. I don't know what it means.
Necessary is an ambiguous term that gives EPA considerable discretion to determine.
Well, you mean you cite a case where we say necessary is an ambiguous term. But the question is, I'm not sure it's ambiguous here in view of the language of B2, emission standards under this subsection. That includes 6.
Well, I think the question is, why would Congress have created a separate review provision if what it really intended was that every 8 years, EPA would simply start entirely fresh? Why not just write a provision that says
every
8 years?
Well, that's what it says. It says that.
It says subsection.
Exactly what it says.
It says subsection, but in looking at the scope of necessary to revise, EPA's discretion to determine whether it's necessary to revise standards under Section 112D6, mm-hmm. and the reasonableness of EPA's interpretation of that as not requiring it to go back and recalculate the MACT floor, to argue that Congress somehow precluded that interpretation merely by its use of a technical term that describes sections and subsections of the statute.
The language of a statute is not a technical term. This is a clear cross-reference. There's no way to read that section promulgated under this subsection as not including D6. That's not a mistake. Congress, that's the way it wrote the statute.
We're not suggesting that it was a mistake,
yeah.
but that a construction that reads that as requiring EPA to completely recalculate MAC floors,
which, as I said, seems to me to be exactly consistent with what Congress intended when it adopted this amendment, is to force these standards to follow technology.
And Section D6...
Isn't that what Congress intended?
That is generally what Congress intended, yes, and Section D6 requires EPA to periodically review existing standards once they have been promulgated to ensure that they are still following technology. It simply doesn't go so far as to require EPA to go all the way back to recalculating the MACT floor, which could have devastating consequences.
We're going in circles, so you
beg your pardon.
Go ahead and talk about, are there other issues you want to raise with us?
Don't believe.
I mean, you have more time.
Yeah, so.
I don't believe I had anything else I wanted to address, unless the court has further questions.
No. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by addressing EPA's argument that we're precluded.
By the way, are you now happy with the concession I got from the agency? Are you satisfied?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, great.
As I understand it, as a concession, they'll reopen the underlying.
That solves that problem.
Yeah.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you. As far as Cleaner Act Section 307B and whether we're precluded from making our argument that lead was already decided in the 1995 standards, the Section 112 IF-F risk review is entirely new and is a different approach for setting standards.
I think she was only referring to the testing. Part of your argument is you use the test is for lead, right?
That's right.
And her point is, at least with respect to that part of your argument, that test was in the original standard. It hasn't changed, and there was no challenge to it, so it's time barred.
That's right. And
okay.
We're not challenging the use of Method 12.
You're not anymore? You did in your brief.
We said that the rule is in its entirety treats elemental lead as a hazardous air pollutant.
So you're no longer relying on the same test.
We're not relying on the
same
test.
Because you did.
That's correct,
okay,
Your Honor.
All right, great.
We concede that
point. Okay.
However, you made a point earlier about whether lead risk was incidental, whether the NACs were basically incidental. And we think the record reflects Joint Appendix 8, Joint Appendix 3 and 4, that attainment with the lead NACs in the areas surrounding smelter was the point of the 112F revisions, was why the Red 12F revisions were set as they were, and that treats lead as a hazardous air pollutant in effect within the meaning of this court's decision in National Lime. I'd like to briefly turn to the MACT floor resetting issue. There's been a lot of discussion about sections and subsections. I'd like to draw the court's attention to Clean Air Act Section 109D1 concerning review of a National Ambient Air Quality Standard. There, EPA also has a duty to review and revise. And Congress added the language after, review and revise as appropriate in accordance with the requirements of subsection 109B1 for setting original standards. And we believe that is an unambiguous cross-reference, but that 112D6 doesn't contain an unambiguous cross-reference.
Okay.
2 points quickly on standing for vis-a-vis RSR. There's been a discussion of piggyback standing. We don't believe that applies to the first petitioner intervener in a case. You'd never have an intervener if someone didn't have standing, and if you were making arguments that were different, you'd be outside the realm of proper intervention under the National Association of Regulatory Commissioners case. We think that's inapplicable. Finally, Mr. Backstrom mentioned a case he's...
Joe Wyman, finish that point then.
Yes.
Go ahead. I wanted you to... You were responding to the contention that the recent case involving the National Labor Relations Board, it was different. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And will you explain what... Well,
I think our point there is that when you're the first petitioner in a case, first intervener in a case, you do need to demonstrate standing. Otherwise, the standing requirement would have no meaning for interveners because they would be making the same argument as a petitioner who had standing. That's my point. And finally,
the point in Noel Canning was we didn't need to decide whether the Chamber of Commerce had standing or not because it was a plain petition for review by a party to the action. So we didn't say they did have standing. We just said we didn't need to decide because the question wouldn't change. And that is the argument here that is the same circumstance here.
Well, no, it's not quite because...
It's the argument, now, whether it's the case or not.
Yeah, that's true because the intervener is presenting some arguments not presented by the environmental group.
They were all on one brief in Noel Canning.
Yeah, and they obviously weren't here, and in particular, the argument about new sources was not presented by the environmental petitioners.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you, Your Honor. To be clear, we are challenging EPA's decision in regard to the new and existing source standards. The NRDC quote is expressly limited to 112D6. That is why it quotes from that specific language. And holding that that case abrogates the language of 112D2 would dramatically change that case and rewrite the Clean Air Act to some extent.
What did you think of the intervener's argument, or no, the last argument about 109, the explicit cross-reference there?
Your Honor,
and the absence of an explicit cross-reference here.
There was no need for that kind of cross-reference here because 112D2.
Congress did do it. The same thing could have been argued in 109, but Congress did explicitly make a cross-reference.
It's true that that different provision and different framework includes that language, but here D2 is already clear. It applies to all emission standards promulgated under subsection 112D, so there was no need for that additional language in this case.
Okay, but say again what you said about that NRDC in your first sentence, would you?
Yes, of course.
Would you just go through that once more?
Of course. The NRDC
quote. So the difference between this case and that case is what?
Yes, the NRDC quote is expressly limited to D6, which is why it's quoting from the language of D6 alone.
Right.
If the court were to extend that holding to find that it abrogates the language of D2, which was not a question decided in that case, it would dramatically change.
In both cases, wasn't the agency operating under D6, the 8-year rule?
Initially, yes, Your Honor, to decide whether to revise.
Right.
Once EPA recognizes their developments and it must revise, that triggers D2. D2 was never triggered in that case.
We talked about that issue before. I hear your argument.
Yes, because the revised standards are what triggered D2 independently. And the court does not generally issue alternative holdings that decide a case not before it.
Well, we do it all the time.
We do alternative holdings all the time. And there must be, I'll bet there's 25 of them that I've sat on in cases in the last 30 years, 20 years.
Forgive me, Your Honor. One additional point on the D2, D3 is intended to be the principal focus of 112. And finding D2, D3 is just a one-time snapshot would conflict dramatically with congressional intent to make sure that as industry has achieved greater reductions, leaders like ours are.
That's saying that NRDC is incorrectly decided.
No, Your Honor. We don't take issue with NRDC's holding, which is what.
It's saying that that language that we've been quoting in NRDC is incorrect.
No, Your Honor, because that only applied to the language of D6, not to the language of D2. And once D2 to 3 are triggered, it's essential for EPA to continue to have to follow those requirements. Congress, EPA's mentioned adverse consequences to some members of industry, but there are also adverse consequences to industry leaders who voluntarily reduce emissions ahead of the curve and are then not allowed to, they're in reliance, really, that EPA will ultimately update its standards. And their competitors are ultimately not required to do so. It's an unsupported assertion from EPA that ignores that consequence and the consequence to public health. On the industry's argument, very briefly, Your Honor, its argument on the regulation of lead really boils down to a test method and not to a rule that is regulating
Council,
a criteria.
I don't think you have to worry. Right. That's not a very strong argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for rebuttal, right? No one? Yeah, okay.
Good.
Case is submitted. Thank you all.